Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, November 4th, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I'm joined by Carl Hamers, once again, a leading contributor to the Barnes Review. All right, Carl Hamers, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
Excellent, John. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on once again. The November-December 2022 edition of the Barnes Review went to the printer and is being mailed out to all subscribers as we speak. And you can find the announcement up on the website. That's the barnesreview.org, or I should say it's just barnesreview.org. If you go right there, you'll see it right in the slideshow. This issue is up there. You can see the table of contents and some of the introductory editorial and the message from the editor. So do check that out. And of course, if you are not subscribing to the magazine, I highly recommend doing so. You can find those details again at barnesreview.org. And you have two excellent articles published in this current issue of the magazine. And I know we're kind of jumping the gun by discussing Christmas, because that is one of the lead articles, I think. I mean, it's the first article published in the magazine, and it goes very well with the front cover of the magazine as well. So we're going to be discussing Christmas here in early November, when we haven't even celebrated Thanksgiving, which has really always been one of my favorite holidays. Christmas is a great holiday as well. But anyways, again, like I said, the lead article in the magazine you wrote, and it's basically a historical overview of Christmas in America, beginning with attempts by the Puritans in Massachusetts Bay Colony attempting to suppress the celebration of Christmas. And it kind of concludes with more modern, recent attempts to suppress the celebration of the holiday under the guise of, you know, public health and the alleged COVID-19 pandemic. So I thought that was a very interesting way of sort of introducing the topic and then, of course, concluding with it. But yeah, it's a great article, very, very interesting topic, obviously. So quickly, why don't you just give us maybe an overview? What did you learn writing the article? Any important points you'd like to make? And then we can kind of get into some more of the details.
Yes, my approach was to create a kind of bookend for the history of Christmas in America, starting in 1659 with the Puritan ban on Christmas, and ending with 2020 and the attempt by, well, whatever we need to call it, the neo-communists of America to ban Christmas in 2020. You know, and then fill in some of the history in between, but pretty much excluding almost the entirety of the 20th century, just kind of dismissing that as mostly just the secularization and the commercialization of Christmas. But the Puritans banned Christmas for 22 years, from 1659 to 1680. And I don't think the neo-communists, or whatever we might call the current powers that be in America, succeeded at all. They announced the recommendations that people ban their, cancel their travel plans and don't gather indoors with friends and family. But Americans didn't comply, and I'm rather proud of that. It ended up being a success story.
It's a good way to kind of conclude the article. The only Americans that those tactics actually worked on are those that just blindly accept what the authorities say and what the experts recommend and their guidance and all that sort of nonsense, which sadly is far too many of us. But I think you're right. I think most people were frankly sick and tired of these self-righteous clowns getting up there and dictating every little aspects of our lives. And that's certainly the case today, but even back then in the fall of 2020 leading up to Christmas, you have some incredible quotes from two of the most disgusting, quote-unquote, public health experts that I've ever encountered. And we'll get into that shortly. I wanted to actually read. You have a good, like, an excerpt from the, like, it was like the public notice released by the legislature of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in, as you mentioned, 1659. I think it was May 11th, 1659. And this is a public notice. It says here, "The observation of Christmas having been deemed a sacrilege, the exchange of gifts and greetings, dressing in fine clothing, feasting, and similar satanical practices are hereby forbidden, with the offender liable to a fine of 5 shillings. And it's sort of like, I think most Americans would read that and, you know, like satanic practices associated with many of the customs and traditions and rituals that, you know, are practiced by the vast majority of Americans in, you know, in modern America. So this is a pretty interesting public notice. And I'm wondering, what is there, what was the Puritan mindset behind such a public declaration and even implementing, you know, a law to basically ban Christmas and describing the rituals and customs associated with the celebration of Christmas as satanical practices?
That's pretty shocking. I mean, I have to admit that the Puritans had some basis by, you know, the moral standards of Christians, not just at the time, but today as well. Although I just had to feature that public notice. It was so outrageous and, you know, hyperbolic. But it does appear that the practice of Christmas at the time was far more public and was considered a celebration having to do with the abundance of food and drink that was stored up from the harvest time, and people just kind of let loose and they had these wild public parties, really. And well, you know, that's not particularly heinous and certainly not satanic. You could see from the Christian perspective, and I'm not sure if it was exaggeration or defamation, but, you know, there were accounts of, like, public fornication and mass public drunkenness and vandalism and fistfights and...
like public debauchery, sort of, like, in general?
That's a good term, yes. Yeah. But, you know, most likely many of the Christian folks were reasonably well behaved, and they might have exaggerated, you know, isolated incidents. So yeah, they seem to have overdone it. Now, 5 shillings would amount to $31 today, so still a, you know, kind of a minor penalty. But it was thought to be a kind of a direct competition with the Anglicans and the Church of England folks in the Massachusetts Bay Colony as well, kind of, you know, a sectarian dispute. And eventually the Puritans were rebuked on those grounds by, you know, the Charles II administration when they pulled the Massachusetts Bay Colony charter later on. But yeah, to answer your question, they had some legitimate basis, perhaps, but seemed to have gone overboard. And, you know, the Puritans have a reputation for being a little uptight.
Right. They take their religion very, very seriously. And that's pretty obvious by reading that public notice. I wanted to also bring up, you cite and discuss a book called The Battle for Christmas, written by a Jewish author named Stephen Nissenbaum. And I'm assuming he's an American Jewish author. What I understand anyways, yeah. This, I have not read this book, but you make some interesting comments and sort of, you know, discuss, as I mentioned, the book. It was cited by another researcher that you also cited in the book. So I'm curious, can you comment on this book and what's your overall takeaway?
I had to resist, you know, featuring it too much in the essay. I did not want it to become a critique of Nissenbaum, but it is my impulse to, you know, really evaluate what it's trying to say, because it was a very influential book. Battle for Christmas, and it's an important topic, but I felt that Nissenbaum was classically, you know, for Jews, you know, defamatory towards Christians and really towards all Americans. I think I said something in the essay like, he managed the extraordinary accomplishment of insulting both American Christians and secular folks. And I think that was his intention, and that the entire 20th century history of the battle for Christmas, let's say, I didn't really include, because I just kind of summarized that as the attempt to basically secularize and commercialize Christmas. And that was largely done by Jews, and it continues today. So I felt like Nissenbaum was like an early iteration of this battle on Christmas by Jews.
He's like the Christmas version of the culture of critique, right? Where Jews just ridicule and critique and degrade and tear down like every aspect of Western Christian culture, traditional Western Christian culture. And he played his role with the publication of this book, where, you know, you sort of mentioned, you know, he totally downplays or even outright dismisses the Jewish role in secularizing and commercializing the Christmas holiday that we saw throughout the 20th century. And certainly we see that today. And taking the deep religious and familial aspect of the holiday totally like out of the celebration. I mean, of course, there's plenty of Americans that still take the religious aspect of the Christmas celebration very seriously, but overall, I think the Jews have played a key role in secularizing this holiday. And this is something that's, of course, rarely ever mentioned. I mean, have you seen like I follow a lot of very like explicitly Jewish publications, and you'll see articles in like the Jewish Daily Forward, for example, or the Jewish Telegraph Agency, where it's almost like articles boasting about the Jewish role in like the modern phenomenon, like the modern Christmas industry, and like how like Jews wrote like all the more recent popular Christmas songs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the role in Hollywood and sort of like the showbiz industry, and how that's how Christmas is portrayed in some of these movies and television shows and whatnot. I mean, it's really astonishing how Jewish the modern Christmas industry is. But I guess, I mean, it's frankly unsurprising for somebody like me who has, you know, studied the reality of Jewish power and influence in society. It's just yet another aspect of it.
Yeah, exactly. I feel Nissenbaum engaged in the lie of omission. It wasn't, you know, and he's not about to mention the role that Jews have played in secularizing and really degrading Christmas to a, I don't know the word, a kind of ultra limited commercial endeavor, you know, just monetizing it. It's not a single mention of that, and that amounts to what I call chutzpocrisy on his part.
Oh, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah. Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, a lot of people that are not like serious Christians look at Christmas as it's very, very, it's like this crass materialistic celebration where everybody's supposed to get presents and, you know, go out and spend a bunch of money. It's very, very, very materialistic, I think is the key word, and totally lacking any of the authentic Christmas spirit and Christmas celebrations in America, which have always focused on the family and, of course, the celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ. I mean, that's what the holiday is all about. And, you know, historically, charity, gift giving have been tied into this, family gatherings and other, you know, family events and going to church and celebrating the holiday. And you know, that's very much been degraded and sort of ridiculed and downplayed by the Jewish establishment.
Yes. I mean, Nissenbaum even managed to degrade the Christian tradition of giving alms to the poor and supporting the less fortunate. His final chapter was something like, Tiny Tim and Other Charity Cases. And he just denigrates and like insults this whole, you know, Christian impulse to help people that are less fortunate. That was his great accomplishment. But not to over fixate on that. It was just a kind of a sidelight I thought I'd focus on as just an example of some of the sources that are distorting the understanding of the history of Christmas.
Well, I think it was good to include that bit in there. Of course, it immediately piqued my interest, you know, with the topics that I'm interested in. And I don't think you overdid it by any means. I think it was an interesting aspect of the article. You kind of provide a timeline of some of the key developments in the sort of like public consciousness of the Christmas holiday, and some of the key books, for example, that have been sort of, you know, instrumental in how the holiday has evolved over the years. You want to talk about this, the timeline that's in the article?
Yes, it's entirely in the 19th century, starting in 1819. And what struck me about it was 4 out of the 5 entries are basically fiction. This is media influences on, you know, the not just the perception of Christmas, but the practice and the celebration of Christmas, which, you know, it's likely to show up on the historical record. I would have liked to have found more of the various churches' influences, but that's not sort of like historiography. That would take a deeper research. But, you know, starting in 1819, Washington Irving, the great American novelist, published the Sketchbook of Geoffrey Crayon, Gent. That was a short story. There was a short story in that book of stories depicting a English squire inviting peasants into his home for Christmas and, you know, showing the celebration cross class, different social classes fraternizing together for Christmas.
There's that like charity aspect of Christmas, right?
Yes, and you know, the social classes didn't usually intermingle, but his book, or the short story, you know, kind of promoted that concept, and it actually led to some mingling of the classes. Then we come to 1822, the 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. We know about this poem even today. And I was interested to find out that it was thought to be written by Episcopal minister Clement Moore, but it turns out Major Henry Livingston wrote it. So there's a misunderstanding of the author. And it depicted St. Nicholas, the Dutch settlers in New York, kind of brought their, you know, mythology or legend of St. Nicholas, who was a Christian saint in the 3rd and 4th century, who, you know, gave all of his goods away to the poor, and especially the children. And they came to call him Sinterklaas, St. Nicholas. And then...
Yeah, and of course, everybody knows 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. I mean, that's a very, very famous poem in American history. I mean, I grew up reading that, you know, leading up to Christmas, for example.
I'm trying to remember the actual title. That was like the simplification of the title.
The longer version is Account of a Visit from St. Nicholas, I believe.
That's right. All about the saint, the Christian saint. By 1848, Charles Dickens wrote The Christmas Carol. Everyone knows that story. Subtitled Being a Ghost Story of Christmas. And what I found interesting about that is, well, along with the conversion of this miserly, wretched, rich banker, you know, you have to wonder if that's a Semitic depiction. But the ghost...
Ebenezer Scrooge you're referring to?
Ah, yes, indeed.
Yes, yep, exactly. Yeah, it does make you wonder what sort of caricature that was representing back then.
Dickens did write about Jews in other of his works, you know, and not in a cryptic way, but in a way people of the time understood. But it's not clear whether Scrooge is Semitic. But his ghosts, all three of the ghosts who appear, are definitely not Christian. They are pagan, you know, which is a sort of an interesting thought, right? The first ghost was Ghost of Christmas Past was like a maiden. She had a flame burning above her head and a wreath, I think. The Ghost of Christmas Present was that like Dionysian character, that Bacchus figure with a big beard and big belly and fur robes. He liked to celebrate. He was all about joy and feasting. But he had those two like waif children under his robe that he showed to Scrooge. And one was want and one was hunger, I think. And Scrooge was, he was just devastated to see that. He told the ghost, like, cover them up. I don't want to look at that. And that was a Ghost of Christmas Present, you know, people suffering and starving. And then the Ghost of Christmas Past, of course, was the Grim Reaper, which I don't actually know the full mythology, but obviously a kind of figure that developed in the mythology of the early agriculturalists when Europeans were first developing agriculture. You know, this death figure, definitely not Christian.
Right. But yet a key piece of literature that had a profound influence and impact on the Christmas tradition in America.
Britain as well. And of course, the best film adaptation is the black and white British version. But later on, George C. Scott played Scrooge and it couldn't quite do it the same value as the British. He played Patton as well, you might remember.
Right.
Not to digress, by 1863, Thomas Nast, the cartoonist, drew up a depiction of Santa Claus, basically, on the cover of Harper's Weekly, taken from "Twas the Night Before Christmas" poem. And that really, really solidified the character of Santa Claus in the public mind. And much later in the 20th century, the Coca-Cola company adopted the image with the red and white color scheme that Coca-Cola had. So crass commercialization at that point. But yeah, we saw Santa Claus on the cover of Harper's.
And Nast is one of the most iconic political cartoonists in American history, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean I remember this image as well. I mean, you can find it online, but yeah, this had a very powerful influence on just the imagery associated with Christmas.
Yeah, that was the first and like ongoing depiction of the character. And then we have the political and really religious day in Christmas history, June 26, 1870. When President Ulysses S. Grant, who was a devout Methodist, declared Christmas an official national holiday, really a religious and political holiday, because at the time they were working to bring the nation back together after the post-Civil War era and the Reconstruction efforts.
Right, yep. Yeah, and that's interesting. I guess I didn't realize... I guess I'd never really looked it up, like when Christmas was officially declared a national holiday, but yeah, 1870, so well over 100 years at this point, 150 years almost, or I guess over 150 years at this point. And yeah, it's still obviously one of the most important and widely celebrated holidays throughout America, throughout the Western world.
Oh yeah, it has to be considered the premier holiday throughout the West, throughout the Christian white West, particularly. You know, was it this year that the Biden administration declared Juneteenth a holiday?
Yeah, jeez. This is absurd. You know,
Grant was sincere about this. It had a religious and political significance, and whatever they're declaring today that's a whole nother topic, but you just can't compare.
Exactly. And then we sort of move on to modern attempts to cancel Christmas. However, they were not done from a puritanical perspective. They were done under the guise of public health, as I mentioned previously, in, you know, the alleged COVID-19 pandemic, which I've always been extremely skeptical about. But they certainly, these alleged public health experts certainly, you know, use this alleged pandemic, this crisis, to advance a variety of very tyrannical agendas, none of which, in my view, were constitutional. And as I mentioned previously, you quote, who is it, Lena Wen, who's this like left-wing activist, a former president of Planned Parenthood, who's now masquerading as his public health expert on CNN, and of course the infamous Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, who has, you know, always been a key figure in America's public health bureaucracy. And you know, obviously he's become very, very well known during this, you know, alleged pandemic. And man, it's, you know, reading these quotes, it's been, you know, it's, you know, been almost 2 years at this point, but it's just so outrageous, some of the things that they said, and just expected everybody just to blindly go along with it. I mean, literally, I mean, yeah, I could read the quote here from Lena Wen. This is the first one that you quote, and this is leading up, I think actually just shortly after Thanksgiving, leading up to Christmas. Actually, no, I'm sorry. It was actually in December, December 7th. She's on CNN, and there were other people making statements like this, but you know, people like Lena Wen and Dr. Fauci were really like the public face of the messaging relating to COVID, and you know, what precautions needed to be taken and what you could and couldn't do. And she's saying, of course, you know, sort of like the fear-mongering that you know is critical to all of their media appearances. She says, you know, it's of course important to wear a mask, keep physical distancing, but also it's so critically important at this point to avoid indoor gatherings. Anyone who has not canceled their plans yet for Christmas and the New Year should cancel their travel plans and absolutely not gather indoors with anyone who is not in their immediate family. I mean, just the fact that somebody could get up and say this in America and expect to
Oh.
be taken seriously, I mean, it's just
Oh.
outrageous, right?
Oh yeah. Classic communist propaganda. Yeah, you know, communists have always tried to suppress and really destroy religion, Christian religion in particular. That's why I call this neo-communist. It's so straight out of the playbook, you know. And Lena Wen as a Planned Parenthood president just transitioning to some kind of public health advocate. I don't think they did expect anyone to follow it. They couldn't have possibly imagined people would take this seriously, especially Christian folks.
Well,
Well,
unfortunately, plenty of people did. I mean, people were staying home. People were not going to, you know, oh, you can't go out to the park. I remember that was, you know, they had the park shut down. You can't leave your house without a mask. There were plenty of people that went along and blindly accepted this nonsense, which is extremely demoralizing, frankly, and depressing to even think about.
oh yeah, that was part of the objective as well. Just to, you know, communists always assault the culture, and if they can suppress holiday gatherings and religious expression and any kind of cultural event, they're all about that. So you know, when I identify this as neo-communist, I'm being specific. I'm referring to the historical record. So let me do the quote by Fauci, see if I can get in voice for that.
Yeah, go ahead.
He says, "Nobody wants to shut down their holiday season, but we're at a very critical time. We've got to not walk away from the facts and the data." Well, whose facts and data? You know.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's always been the question. Whose facts and data, whose science? I mean, who's coming up with the science that we keep hearing about?
I was studying the facts and data at the time. What, December 2020? They have, you know, all-cause mortality figures and hospitalizations and deaths due to COVID. And the CDC had even admitted that 94% of the deaths were in people that had an average of 2.6 other comorbidities, which they list, you know, cancer, heart disease, you know, pneumonia, diabetes, obesity, Alzheimer's, all the normal killers. You know, 94% of people died of those things.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember right around this time, I think it would have been actually even earlier in 2020, maybe like the late spring, early summer, maybe even into the fall. One of the big hot spots at the very beginning in 2020 was Italy, remember?
Yeah, Lombardy.
And you saw all these headlines about all these people getting sick and dying. And then it came out very quietly, of course, but it was even reported in mainstream media reports that the vast majority, like I don't even have the article in front of me to even cite it, but or to, you know, give you an exact figure, but it was like the vast majority of deaths were elderly people, people like in their late 70s, early 80s, all of whom had multiple comorbidities. So, it, you know, it basically it was more fear-mongering, more just total distortion of, you know, death records, frankly. I mean, that's really what it was. I mean, they were just essentially manipulating the death records and classifying everybody who died during this period as dying of COVID. And, of course, the testing was very problematic. I still, to this day, have never once been tested for COVID, and I don't plan on ever being tested for COVID. I don't even know exactly what COVID is. I don't even know if it's a legitimate, you know, concept to even be concerned about.
Not at all.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you get where I'm coming from. But even like it came, you know, it even was reported. And, you know, you've seen similar reports in this country, you know, after the fact, how, you know, everybody that was dying was basically being just artificially classified as dying from COVID. And, of course, there were financial incentives tied into this with the hospitals. Right. And, you know, big pharma and everything else. And, of course, it was always used as a, you know, for political purposes, frankly, to keep the fear mongering going, to perpetuate the idea that there was this, you know, deadly pandemic, and just to, you know, to drive and reinforce and perpetuate this narrative. That's what it was all about from day one.
And there was a happy ending to this period of the history of Christmas when the records show that Americans set records for the millions of people who traveled on the 3 days leading up to Christmas. You know, it's like nobody listened.
Yeah, and you saw like
the planes were full, the trains, everyone was traveling. Nobody cared. So I felt like that was a great success for the American people.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you also cite a couple of court cases, including an Orthodox Jewish group, basically, in New York, and then the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn, who actually filed lawsuits against the governor of New York at the time, Andrew Cuomo, who, I mean, was one of the most despicable of the governors out there. I mean, him, the woman who replaced him, Kathy Hochul, is just as bad. Governor Newsom in California, Gretchen Whitmer up in Michigan. I mean, you know, a lot of these, you know, left-wing Democrat governors, and even some of the Republicans went along with this nonsense. But the governor of New York, California, I mean, they really just all of a sudden declared themselves king of their states, that they could literally dictate who can do what, when, you know, when they could, when people could leave their house, when they could drive their car, when they could go to work, when they could, when and where and how they could worship. I mean, all in direct violation of the Constitution.
Right. In the lawsuit, they were bringing the suit because for arbitration, arbitrary and capricious. The governor, you know, of New York, declared that only 10 people could congregate in a church in the red zones and 25 in the orange zones. Meanwhile, within those zones, restaurants were wide open. Even like liquor stores and abortion clinics, there were no restrictions on them. So that, you know, they felt like this was a unjust targeting of the churches, and they won their case. The Orthodox Jewish organization, Agudath, I forget the name. They kind of teamed up, filed a parallel lawsuit, and they won as well.
I think the congregation was Agudath Israel,
right,
in New York, or I guess specifically in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Oh, good on them.
Yeah, I agree.
I heard from the beginning that the Orthodox Jews were defying the lockdown orders, and I approved. I thought that was like a success for religious reasons.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, again, these sorts of declarations and mandates and the guidance, none of this is legal. It was all you read into the details, and there were exceptions, and it was basically just recommendations, right, that everybody was just expected to go along with, when all it took was for you to stand up and just assert your rights. There was I actually wrote a story, it was probably a year and a half ago now. A gentleman in Orange County, California, in Huntington Beach, owned a restaurant, and I've actually ate at the restaurant. It's amazing food, an Italian restaurant. And from the very beginning, he did not comply with anything. He didn't comply with the face mask nonsense, with basically anything, with any of the recommendations that they made, with putting up like the plexiglass, which you still see in supermarkets and gas stations even to this day. He didn't go along with any of it. And that, you know, the public health authorities would come out and, you know, threaten him basically, and they I think they did end up charging him, but none of it actually stood up in court. It was basically just intimidation. That's all it was, this entire time essentially. And that applies equally with the quote unquote vaccine mandates. I mean, if you just said no and invoked your religious exemption or health exemption, I mean, you didn't have to take the vaccine, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well, just recently a lawsuit was successful. There were healthcare workers who claimed religious exemption. They filed for religious exemption, and they were denied. So they were fired, and they couldn't work. But a recent lawsuit required them to be reinstated on their jobs, and they were given back pay for this time that they were fired.
Yeah, there have been a number of cases like that. Even the sanitation workers in New York City just won a lawsuit. Yeah, and I don't know all the specific details, but it's definitely something. I mean, obviously you have to when we're living under a totally tyrannical government like this. I mean, you have to stand up for your rights, otherwise you're just going to get ran over. You know, so sometimes it does take it's going to take some sacrifice and some fighting back, some pushing back, to actually guarantee your God-given rights.
That's right. Just to finish up with the Christmas essay, I was very impressed with the writing of Christian author Karina Benton. She was speaking fire in this essay, not just against the lockdown agents, but against the Christian churches and pastors that went along with the lockdowns. I mean, she had a fierce voice in this essay. People can find it in the footnotes and read it entirely, but I bring some quotes from her into the essay, including she's points out that there was a strip club in San Diego County that was allowed to stay open during the COVID lockdowns on free speech grounds while all the churches were shut down. You know, and this was like an outrage and just a heresy to Christian folks. And I really love the way she wrote about that. It was inspiring.
Yeah, so we got strip clubs remaining open. We have, of course, all the big box stores, the Walmarts, the Targets. Amazon, of course, is still operating. Yeah, churches are closed. Abortion clinics, liquor stores, marijuana dispensaries in California and other states that have legalized marijuana. Of course, they're all open. You know, it was so obvious, like the agenda behind all of this. And I agree. I mean, the woman that you're mentioning, Karina Benton, criticizing the church leaders that went along with this nonsense is just, and that included even the Pope himself, correct?
Well, yes, the Pope held the liturgies in private, like they excluded the usual attendance by a kind of audience and assistance. And they live streamed it instead, and you know, to save the world from the virus. That was disappointing, but I guess we shouldn't expect much else from Vatican II.
True, yeah.
But I share a personal anecdote. When I was in Oregon, I attended a church gathering in which we were, you know, organizing to resist the lockdowns and maintain our freedom. And people raised their hands, like a lot of people raised their hands saying, you know, our church didn't shut down either, and neither did ours. And my pastor kept our church open. And this went on throughout the meeting, like, must have been a dozen people saying, you know, this is just in one county in Oregon. And I think that was more writ large across the nation. So I closed the essay with a really on a positive note. I feel like America, not just the Christian folks, but everyone put up a strong resistance to the effort to shut down Christmas by the neo-communists. And it was very heartening. I just felt like it was a great proud moment for the American people.
Yes, some of us still do have that rebel spirit, don't we?
We know communism when we see it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, call it whatever you want. I mean, communism, I mean, whatever you want to, however you want to describe it, it's just totally contrary to everything that this country was founded upon, what we were taught growing up, the way, you know, the American Revolution is framed. I mean, it's just totally contrary to all of that. The whole entire COVID pandemic scenario was just like one big slap in the face to America and everything that America is supposed to stand for.
That's right. You could call it globalist. You could call it Jewish supremacist. You could call it world controller class, extreme Talmudic fundamentalist. I have a number of labels I use. And neo-communists really seem to apply literally, like specifically to the attempt to shut down Christmas.
I agree. I think that is a good way of looking at it. So, well, this actually segues good into your next article, which is later on in the magazine. And that deals with the origins of the modern for-profit medical industry and the systematic suppression and ultimate elimination, basically, of alternative natural health schools and practitioners, which really sort of began with the publication of the Flexner Report, written by Abraham Flexner, a Jewish man, and of course the rise of the modern medical establishment, the for-profit pharmaceutical-based modern medical establishment, which is probably one of the leading causes of death in America if you look at the statistics. Which is incredible to think about. And, you know, even prior to the alleged COVID pandemic, I had very little trust or faith in the modern medical system in general. But now, certainly, I want absolutely nothing to do with any of these people, except for maybe a chiropractor, which isn't even really part of this, you know, sort of modern medical system. But anyways, why don't you give us sort of like an overview? Maybe talk about what led you to write this article, what sparked your interest. It's obviously a topic that is very relevant with this COVID pandemic, and it's a topic that I've been interested in for a number of years. In fact, I first discovered this sort of like alternative aspect of, like, I guess more like a better, maybe a better way of putting it is like the revisionist aspect to medicine, to like medical history. And that was reading Eustace Mullins' book Murder by Injection, which, if I'm not mistaken, you actually address and cite in this piece. So why don't you talk about what led you to write this and sort of your, you know what got you interested in this topic, I guess.
Well, John, the same thing that I said last time you asked me this. Hearing about some event or document in history and then wondering, oh, I wonder if the Jews have anything to do with that.
Right.
So making a career of that. And last time I told you that the Jewish role in gun control, something I learned about from Kevin MacDonald and Andrew Joyce. And that's got me thinking, well, what else are they involved in? And that led to vaccines. And so I remember hearing people talk about the Flexner Report in my studies. I listened to podcasts, and I think you even interviewed Tim Kelly. And I've heard him mention it. And I see it in things I read and study. But I never really plunged into the details. What is this? Flexner Report. And then I wanted to find out more about it. And along the way, I thought, oh, I wonder if Jews are involved. Well, it turns out that not just Abraham Flexner, but his whole family. He had 8 brothers. Well, I shouldn't say that. 8 siblings. Many of them were boys. Were central in this process of tearing public health and medicine, you know, healthcare approaches away from natural approaches, you know, alternative. Of course, they weren't alternative at the time. And really channeling it into for-profit pharmaceutical drugs made from petroleum, which the Rockefellers controlled, and devices and surgeries, and, you know, away from this. Really, these approaches that, at the very least, will do no harm, and in many cases, were more beneficial. And although I want to say that there was the tiniest validity to Flexner's claim that some of these approaches were quackery and were fleecing people of their money and not providing any benefit. But that was just a pretext to steer the medical industry into the hands of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and really the big capitalists.
Yeah, so talk about the actual Flexner Report. I've never read the entire thing. You can find it online. I know it's available from like archive.org, for example. But I mean, my general understanding is, I guess, sort of what I mentioned. Like, it's basically his assessment, his investigation into medical practices at the time. And this was published, what, in 1910, 1911?
1910.
Okay, 1910. And it was basically like recommendations for essentially shutting down these alternative practices and colleges and schools of medicine and creating this one centralized, standardized, pharmaceutical-based approach to medicine. I mean, is that more or less right, or how, what would you add to that?
Yeah, that's an excellent summary. We should add that some of the details, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching funded the Flexner Report and funded Abraham Flexner. He was chosen by a man named Pritchett, who was the AMA Council on Medical Education director. Now, why Pritchett chose Flexner is really quite a puzzle. Flexner was, he had a BA. He was not a doctor. He operated an alternative school in Louisville, Kentucky, which was kind of a curious place. It didn't have lectures or textbooks or grades or tests. You know, he was experimenting with education. I would say that the reason Pritchett and the Carnegies and, as we'll see, the Rockefellers chose Flexner was because he had a known disdain for traditional education. And he investigated 155 schools, mostly in the U.S., but some in Canada, of which he called many of them unconscionable quacks. You know, and he celebrated Johns Hopkins University as the best example of medical education, where he had gotten his education, and which I write about in the essay. You know, it's one of the epicenters of evil today, one of the big promoters of the COVID scam.
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned Event 201 and the role that they played in that. Johns Hopkins University was at the center of that. It's a very influential university in the United States. And, of course, it's heavily financed by Jewish, quote-unquote, philanthropists.
Michael Bloomberg.
Is it Michael Bloomberg? Okay, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, the Bloomberg School.
Yep.
But anyways, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's just – it's interesting the role that – I mean, Johns Hopkins University goes all the way back to Flexner, so no wonder it plays such a key role in the modern medical tyranny we see today.
Yes, exactly. Of course, jumping over the whole period in between, but I was struck by his advocacy for Johns Hopkins. And then for 13 years, he was the on the board of governors of the Rockefeller Foundation, and they helped him set up another experimental school through working with Columbia University, another epicenter of evil. Columbia gave refuge to the Frankfurt School of Social Research, these Jews who are escaping National Socialist Germany because they were, you know, promoting homosexuality and degeneracy. And well, they were given a welcome home at Columbia University, who worked with Flexner to set up the alternative school. Then, so you can see how Abraham Flexner was closely associated with the Rockefellers. So the Carnegies and the Rockefellers working together. And then, you know, he ended up, his report ended up shutting down a large number of these schools and concentrating the control over medical education into fewer and fewer schools and raising the standards for the students. You know, right? They set like pre-qualifications, aiming to attract students from the upper classes, you know, excluding the working class through some of these requirements, you know, pre-education. And then I wrote it all down in the essay.
Well, and it created like, I mean, literally, I think it's a good way of looking at it. It created like this medical industry and an education industry where you were, you know, look at like modern like medical students today. You go through 4 years of undergrad and then 4 years of medical school, and then you're basically, what do they call it? Not an apprentice, but a, what are you in? There's a specific title.
Intern?
Not an intern. You're a resident, I think they call it. You're like a resident at a hospital where you're, I don't think you really get paid, certainly not a doctor's salary. So it's just like this big like scam, essentially. And I mean, I think that's a good way of looking at modern education in general. Like the modern university system is just one big scam. You know, the vast majority of students enrolled in modern universities have no business even attempting to go to college. They're not going to complete it, and they're just going to get into a bunch of debt. But, you know, you see the rise of that sort of mindset and the institutionalization of it with, you know, the Flexner Report and the subsequent consolidation of medical education.
That's right. It was the openly stated objective of the Flexner Report to raise the income of doctors and reduce their numbers, but raise their income. So very much focused upon money and profits, and thereby control the doctors much more closely with a concentrated curriculum. And excluding things like herbal medicine, even physical therapy, you know, Flexner put in the category of quackery, which I think
even
is one of the best.
Physical therapy, really? Wow.
I think they called it something else, mechanical therapy. Yes, chiropractic, homeopathy, herbalism, all quackery. Can't have it. It's not in the new curriculum. And they made an attempt, and they succeeded primarily in linking medical education to the state, each of the state's medical, educational programs, you know, state-owned colleges. So they worked with the governors and at the state level and took it away from any kind of private operations.
Right. So like it was like very much centralized, and in order to even be like accredited as like a medical school or medical university, you had to go through this sort of centralized process run by these elites like the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and all these other people. Is that basically right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Okay. And you have some very interesting statistics in the report, in the article, in the Barnes Review, you know, sort of outlining how the number of medical schools in operation in the United States and how they just declined like almost by 100%, I think, actually, over the course of like 20 years.
Right. Yep. I found some sources of the actual numbers year by year. And there was some decline prior to Flexner. but it really accelerated after the Flexner Report. The Flexner Report gave them basically an excuse. It was considered a research document that validated the shutting down of these schools. And Flexner, you can read some of the verbatim statements that Flexner made in the report, just slamming some of these schools and defaming them. And he uses the term quackery, and he depicts these facilities that are like loaded with filth and, you know, like a lone hamster waiting in a cage for its ultimate fate, you know, a tattered and dirty mannequin. You know, he's got these graphic depictions of these deplorable conditions in these schools. And, you know, you hardly believe that they're honest. You know, just classic defamation.
Right. Very, like, sensational and just designed to tarnish the image of any alternative to this consolidated, you know, medical establishment that they were hoping to institutionalize, which they were very, very successful at this point in doing.
Yes, unfortunately. I'm thinking of a tangent, but I want to mention there's a little sideline in the article about how Abraham Flexner worked with the Bambergers, who were a wealthy Jewish family that owned and operated these large department stores. And I remember as a boy, the Bambergers department store. You know, it wasn't that long ago they were still around. But Flexner and the Bambergers opened the Institute for the Advanced Study of Medicine. You know, so, and that was the school where that was expressly devoted to accepting Jewish applicants, you know, because they claimed that Jews were persecuted and prevented from entering medical school. So they set up a special school that was, you know, more preferential to accepting Jewish students.
Right. You know, one other comment I had just reading this article and sort of reflecting on it now, it's almost like a case study in the way Jewish nepotism works. Right. I mean, just studying like the Flexners and, you know, the consolidation of the medical industry in general and what we see today, it really is just a group of very ethnocentric, you know, highly, highly, extremely aware of their Jewish identity, very much concerned about anti-Semitism, and, you know, of course, Hitler and the National Socialist regime, and, you know, after World War II, of course, the Holocaust, and the rise of anti-Semitism or racism or white supremacy, and just how they networked together, worked together, pooled their resources, which were very vast and have only grown since then. You know, it really is sort of like a case study in how these people operate. And it has, to a certain extent, I mean, it does have something to do with their ability and their IQ and their work ethic and those sorts of things. But overall, I think the primary factor in Jewish success in America is their nepotistic attitude and mindset, coupled with their, you know, extremely high levels of, you know, their Jewish identity and ethnocentrism, right?
Right. Exactly, John. And when you look through the Flexner family, his brother Simon, brother Bernard, these were big movers and shakers. Simon also in the transition of the medical system. He was the first director of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. Simon was. He was a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation for many years. He was a professor at Johns Hopkins, went on to University of Pennsylvania, another epicenter of evil in the modern day. And Simon was acknowledged by Abraham in the acknowledgments of the Flexner Report as providing constant and generous assistance. So he had, you know, direct brotherly nepotism in the Flexner Report. Bernard.
Can I mention one little tidbit, a really brilliant nugget of information in the section on Simon Flexner in the article, in his connection to UPenn, University of Pennsylvania. You talk about how The Perelman School of Medicine, founded by a Jewish billionaire, Ron Perelman, sort of set up the School of Medicine there. But this is also where mRNA technology was developed that's used in today's COVID-19 vaccines, right?
Dr. Drew Weissman, that's
Yeah,
right.
well, and right, and another Jewish doctor involved in the creation of this technology, quote unquote technology, which they, I mean, you can listen to their TED Talks and listen to their, candid conversations amongst the other health experts. It's gene therapy, gene altering, technology, basically. I mean, I don't know how this could be viewed as anything other than a direct corruption of God's creation, something
Yes,
that should
exactly.
be totally, abhorrent to anybody thinking critically about what's going on with this.
That's right. It's literally a corruption. There's some confusion out there that Robert Malone was the inventor of mRNA technology used in the vaccines. And he claims that, but it turns out that Malone and his team were not able to stabilize this substance they made, this messenger RNA. But Dr. Weissman and his colleague, a Hungarian woman, I can't recall her name, they found a way to stabilize this by basically corrupting it with a chemical compound known as uridine. And it made it applicable in the vaccines. Before that, it wouldn't have been. They call it modified messenger RNA, and it's chemically modified. It's basically poisoned. So, I don't know who wants that injected into their body, but Drew Weissman was the man who actually developed the messenger RNA into a form that it could be used.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And again, ties directly back to the Flexner brothers and their role in creating this totally evil medical system we see today.
It was a large family. Like I said, there were nine siblings. I was struck by perhaps the most powerful and influential Flexner was Bernard. He attended the Paris Peace Conference with the Zionist delegation, that created the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. He was the founder of the Palestine Economic Corporation, which began the development of the economy and land ownership in Palestine that was to become the nation of Israel. And he was a founder of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now,
Wow, this guy was really, and he had his hand in everything, didn't he?
Council on Foreign Relations was said to be a American development of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, I think it was called in Britain.
Yes, yep, an offshoot of it, basically, right?
What they called Chatham House. That was called Chatham House, yes. An
Yeah.
offshoot. But here's a Flexner, like one of the founders of this thing that is now like a, they call it a think tank, but it's like a policy setting center that really dictates to the government. It owns a lot of media. And it's today it's primarily run by Jews. I don't know if I linked to that in the article, if that's a footnote of mine.
Yeah, you have an article on your Substack page, which I should mention, is called Taboo Truth on Substack. I'll have a link over to your Substack page when I post this podcast, and I'd encourage people to obviously check out your Substack. And I subscribe to it by email, so I get an email notification anytime you publish something over there. But yeah, you wrote an article, The Jews of the CFR, back in, I think it was in July of 2022, of just this past summer. And I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name that is the current president, but
Richard Haas.
he's Jew. Yeah, okay, R Richard Haass. Yes, yeah, Jew, a fanatical anti-Russian warmonger. I mean, these guys are all, of course, bending over backwards to get to get America involved and to destroy Russian and start World War III, essentially. But yeah, he's the president now, and I'm sure there's many others involved and many other Jews involved in the CFR. I don't know all the details off the top of my head, but you've obviously written about it, and I'd encourage people to check out that article.
Yeah, thank you. Check out
But
Taboo
yeah.
Truth. That's kind of a tangent, but I was stunned to hear that Bernard Flexner was a co-founder of the CFR all the way back in 1921.
Right. Well, yeah, and I mean, in addition to being a delegation to the Paris Peace Conference, and helping create the state of Israel and being like a major, Zionist leader, essentially. I mean, there was a whole network of these individuals, but here's a Flexner tied into that, tied into the medical establishment. I mean, they got their hands in everything.
I know it. Two other Flexners deserve mention. The son of the youngest Flexner, Washington, was named Lewis. He was a doctor and a professor at UPenn, engaged in brain research, and which led to today's, what do we even call it, transhumanist Neuralink technology and brain chips and this whole madness that's coming out of the World Economic Forum. Lewis was one of the early pioneers of direct, brain research. Another offspring, let's see here. Excuse me a moment. Eleanor Flexner was the daughter of Abraham and his wife. She was a communist. She joined the U.S. Communist Party. Abraham, his wife, and Eleanor were devout feminists, basically Marxist feminists. Eleanor wrote The Century of Struggle, Women's Movement in the U.S.
I think it's the women's rights movement in the U.S., yeah, published in 1959.
Thank you. So here we have a subversive communist feminist, next generation of the Flexners. It's so typical. It's just, it's always astonishing to find these things, but it's also always just so expected.
Well, it's like one of those things. I mean, once you really start researching, I mean, just the role that Jews have played in you could even just do modern American society. I mean, or take a broader look and look at, all of Western civilization, the role that Jews have played. It is frankly just dumbfounding. And the fact that it's so well documented, it's not as if this is just made up by, evil people that hate Jews for no reason at all. This is very, very well sourced. I was just reading an article the other day published by Mike King, who used to have the website Tomato Bubble. Now it's the Real History Channel. And he's excerpting an article from the New York Times published in the early 1900s about the Rothschilds and how much power and influence they had and how much wealth they had back then in the early 1900s. And it was incredible. It was like, oh my gosh, I want to say $2 billion that they were acknowledged to have back then. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the, I don't know what that translates to today's money, but I mean, so it's not, again, this is, and then, you talk about the Rothschilds and you're denounced as a conspiracy theorist, as if it's just made up some just fairy tale that, again, people that just hate Jews and blame them for everything made up, as if there's no basis in reality to it. Right. When it's a very well-established fact, people have written books about it. Scholars have written books about it. I mean, throughout history, it's incredible. And now we see that on full display with, some of these rappers coming out and making comments about Jews and Jewish power and, the groveling that's taking place and the ritual defamation of them that is taking place. I don't know if you've been following any of that. I know that's a totally separate topic. Well, I mean, it's related, obviously, to Jews, but not necessarily related to the article.
Yes, Kanye West. Allow me to mention my latest essay published at the Occidental Observer was, I find this also fascinating. As you said, there is a excellent historical record. There are well-credited accounts of Jewish power, Jewish money. And so I wrote this essay about the banking dynasties, it was called, that founded the Federal Reserve. And there are a number of sources that list 8 families. Well, at an immediate glance, 6 of them are Jews. Rothschilds, Warburgs, Kuhn and Loeb, Schiff. Yeah, I can name all. It turns out the Lazard brothers in France is also Jewish. The only one that wasn't was the Rockefellers. And so when you mention the Rothschilds, One of the startling things about this research I did for this essay was that all of these families intermarried. They became one big extended family. You know, Jacob Schiff married Kuhn and Loeb's daughter. He married into the Kuhn and Loeb families, and the Warburgs married Rothschild daughters. There were five Warburg sons. There were five Rothschild sons. There were three Lazar brothers. Even the families themselves had like multiple people all intermarrying each other, forming one giant worldwide Jewish banking conglomerate. It was astonishing. I'd like to put together one of those genealogies you can see of the family lines with the circles and the lines, and you know, this is the next generation.
It's right. Just, yeah. To kind of see it visually, the connections. Yeah.
The nepotism and the consolidation of power, not just into this tribe or this sub-race of people, but into this family. I do end the essay on the Flexner Report by mentioning other Jewish families that were promoting drugs. The Sassoons and the Cassells, I think it was called, who promoted the opium wars, you know, shifting the opium from India into China in the mid-1800s. And then today, a very short while ago, the Sackler family promoting the opioids OxyContin through Purdue Pharma. And I don't know, there were some changes, editorial changes, so I don't know what I can say. But in the end, I said, beware of Jewish families promoting drugs. You know, this is a good summary of Flexner.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at it, you know, throughout history, and it's seems to be, anyways, this the same ethnic group involved at the highest levels promoting drugs, promoting this sort of medical system that we see today, and it's undeniable. I mean, it's not, again, some unfounded quote-unquote conspiracy theory. It's very well documented and very well established, and yet it's one of these topics that you're just simply not allowed to speak about in polite society. And if you have a big enough platform, you know, you're going to get canceled and fired and, you know, ostracized and subjected to ritual defamation and right. All of the rest that we see.
At very least, I feel we are beholden to document this. I feel like the least we can do is get it onto the historical record. So I'm working on the proofs for a book. It's mostly a compiling of my essays on, you know, the Jewish issue in COVID. I call it Covert COVID Culprits. And it's, you know, 15 chapters, 300-page book with 700 footnotes about the Jewish role in this whole COVID phenomenon over the last 2 years. And I'm really eager to get this book out and published and into people's hands, at the very least as a record of what occurred, and at best, hopefully, as a motivation and just a knowledge so that we can rescue ourselves from this agenda.
Right. Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. I mean, that's what drives me, is that this stuff has to be documented for the record. It has to be openly discussed by somebody. You know, I mean, if only we had somebody in a position of power to actually step up and do something and say these things out loud. I mean, you know, we see that with Kanye, with Yee, but you know, you see what happens when you know, somebody in his position actually gets up there and says some of these things. But needless to say, it's like you said, it's one of those things that absolutely has to be documented and discussed, I think, scholarly and, you know, responsibly to a certain extent, obviously. And I think that's exactly what we do at the Barnes Review. That's exactly what you do with your work, not only in the Barnes Review, but also on your Substack, and, of course, at the Occidental Observer. And I will have links over to, as I mentioned, both your Substack and your page at the Occidental Observer, so people can check out your work there. And yeah, Carl, I'm looking forward to the book. I know you've been working hard on it, and I think it'll be an excellent read. And we'll definitely stay in touch and do this again in the near future.
Looking forward to it, John. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Carl. We'll talk to you later.
Good day.
Okay.